Thanks for sticking around to hear more of Tell Us Something Radio. This next story was recorded in May of 2012 at the Top Hat Lounge in Missoula. The theme for the evening was, I Got Lucky. Mike Robinson talked about his days as a geologist when he worked at a seismic job that involved dynamite at an open-pit gold mine. In order to facilitate efficiency, he rigged up a detonation mechanism that required a whole lot of trust to operate. Mike calls his story El Gordito.
The theme tonight is I got lucky, and I've been lucky a lot in my life. The first professional job I ever got in my life, I got without even trying, without even looking for it. I just graduated undergrad here, geology. I was signed up to go to grad school at Utah State University. They were still on quarters. That meant they started in October, which gave the whole month of September to be in Montana for the archery season. A friend and I started off at the Lolo border. It was great. It was a great huckleberry season. Caught a lot of fish, saw a few elk. After a week, we were going to move to southern Montana. My friend was going to be unemployed after the end of this adventure. So he said, since we're swinging through town, I have a few resumes out. I'm going to make a few phone calls and follow up. Like the second call he made, the guy says, you know, I don't know if I need anybody this winter, but I need someone next week, and I need two people. You have a friend. It was just a week gig. Sounded pretty good. I have a little money. Still 2 weeks of the archery season. This guy had lined up a lot of work in South America after this, and one thing kind of led to another. And 2 weeks later, I'd postponed grad school, and I was on a plane to Bolivia. I was going to be a geophysicist. I had taken one class in geophysics. It was the only class I had ever... I was a pretty good student. I failed this one. I skipped the final to go on a ski trip. The work was good. We had lots of projects. We did electrical geophysics. It was all exploration, looking for gold and other minerals. We did electrical surveys up in the mountains, a lot of fun. We did these magnetic surveys. I did one down in the rainforest. That was a lot of fun. My story tonight is about the most interesting job I had. It was a seismic job. It was for a gold mine. There was an existing gold mine. It was an open pit along the fault zone where the gold and mineralized. This place kind of looked like Nevada, except at around 14,000 feet. Very barren. The valleys were just completely flat, full of clay. The foothills rose up. It was rock. The mine was right at the foothills going down to the valley where the fault zone headed. And what the mine owners wanted to know was, is this fault zone extended under the valley? Were there any places where the bedrock kind of came up, where there was minimal clay, where it was economic to remove that clay and then mine the gold underneath? And my job as a geophysicist was to map the subsurface topography of this bedrock and see if they could find any of these high spots. To do this, we're going to use a seismic survey. I don't know if you know about seismic. That's where you send shock waves through the ground. You can do this with a sledgehammer and a steel plate on the ground. You put a plate, strike it with a sledgehammer, and the shock waves go down. When they hit something harder than what they're traveling through, they reflect back up to the surface. You measure the time it takes them to go down and come back up. You estimate how fast they're moving. You calculate for distance. That was the theory. I'd never done this before. The mine gave me all the equipment I needed. They gave me a couple pickup trucks, which is great. They hired four guys out of the local village to be my crew. And because the bedrock was much too deep for a sledgehammer to work, they gave me 50 cases of dynamite. I'm 22 years old. This is great. Start off a little slow. We figured it out after a while. We welded this pipe cap on it. We'd pound that into the ground and then pull it back up, and that left a hole. We'd drop five or six sticks of dynamite down in there. You'd take a blasting cap, squish that in a stick of dynamite, drop that in the hole, maybe another stick or three on top of that. You put the dirt on it. And then you string out these geophones. These are little listening devices that detect sound waves. You string these out along your survey line. You take cables from all this back to the pickup truck. You hook the geophones up to this recording device. And then the lines from the dynamite, you hook one in up to the positive terminal of a car battery. And when everything's quiet, you look at the things, nothing's moving, you turn the machine on and touch the other end of the cable to the dynamite, and that sets off the dynamite. The shock wave starts, and you can watch it move through the geophones. And when it's moved through the last one, you turn it off, and you move down the line, you start again. It all worked very well for a while. We had four transects. They got deeper into the valley. They're about 2 miles long. They got deeper. When you got deeper, two things. You had to use more dynamite because you have to go a long ways deeper. Also, these sound waves, as they travel, they go down at an angle. And to detect them, you have to get broader. So we had to use more and more cable. And it got to one point where I went to touch the dynamite off, and it didn't go off. The 12 volts of the battery couldn't push the current out to the blasting cap and back. So I was pretty clever. I thought, well, we'll just take the car battery out of this one, hook it up in series, well, 204 volts. And that worked well for a while. We got deeper yet, and I said, another car battery, 36 volts. And it didn't take me too long to figure out that I didn't have to waste time taking the car batteries out. I'll just leave them in place. We had lots of wire, so you just string it up, you know, positive, negative, back. It all worked well. The crew was great. They were teaching me Spanish. Not Spanish I could use in polite company, but they were great. One guy, El Gordito, he had a lot of fun with the dynamite. He would take the spare tire from the truck, put it on top, and see how far, 25, 36 of dynamite would launch a spare tire in the air. But who's curious, it's really high. So, you know, after everything, you do it enough, it kind of breaks down a routine. And the routine broke down to two guys, their job was to put the geophones in. Another two guys, Edwin and El Gordito, they were putting the dynamite in. My job was to sit back in the truck and get all the instruments ready. And I was doing that on this particular day. You had to string blankets over the windows because the recording paper was photosensitive. I was putting the batteries out, positive, negative, all the way back. And I was going to get a piece of equipment, and I heard an explosion. And I froze, and my heart just started racing in this chill in my spine, and I know exactly what I did. I connected all the wires. I wasn't thinking. I was just, you know, doing it quick. And 600 yards away, Edwin and El Gordito, they had put the dynamite on the ground. They were doing their job. They were putting the dynamite on the ground. They were probably using 26 or so. Blasting cap, put it in there, piled the dirt in, grabbed the wires from blasting cap, connected to the wires that I was connected to, and it was a live circuit, and they were instantly blown across this desert prairie. I was shaken. I didn't know what to do. My knees crumbled. I was in the dirt. I had only one thought, and that was, can I somehow heroically go and jump into this explosion and, you know, save somebody? Silly idea. There was El Gordito and Edwin. Edwin had invited me to his house a couple days before. He had four kids. He had a mud shack. It was about as big as this porch. Four kids. There's no way to make money in rural Bolivia. He was proud to have this job. You know, provide for his family. You could just tell that. He was showing me off. I was the guy. I was giving him a job. And his family was proud of him. But now he was dead. And I was sitting there in the dirt, and I was staring off down. I could see the crater down there. And when this is happening, you can't really understand what you're seeing. But I was seeing two figures kind of walking around in the middle of this crater. And I thought they were the other two guys going to get him. But I was looking, and one of the guys was clearly El Gordito. I mean, he was easy to recognize even at 600 yards. And the other guy is Edwin. I could see the hat. And I couldn't understand, because they were in this crater, what had happened. I did what I did. They went and they buried this thing. El Gordito started walking, and Edwin connected the wires. And he took about four steps, 3 seconds, and that's when the dynamite came off, just about from here to there. It was just timing. It was an hour and a half job to put in this dynamite, and he cleared it by about 3 seconds, just walking from here to there. El Gordito, who was probably another 30 yards away, he's the one who got the debris, because the mud kind of mushrooms up and comes out. Edwin was completely clear. His ears rang for a month, I'm sure, but nothing happened to him. This was 17 years ago, something like that. Still, I'll be driving down, it'll be a bright sunny day, and that sound of that explosion will just hit me in my mind, and I'll just see these two guys flying across the prairie. And then it's like waking up from a nightmare. Your heart is racing, you have these shivers on your spine, and you think, wait a second. No, it didn't happen that way. That's because I got lucky.
Mike Robinson is a geologist turned farrier who dabbles in renewable fuels. He once built an adobe wood-fired oven in his backyard, which led to the building of another adobe wood-fired oven, this one portable and in the shape of a garlic bulb. Thus was born Clove Cart Pizza Peddlers. Our next story is from Marlies Borchers. It was recorded in October of 2014 at the Top Hat Lounge in Missoula. The theme that evening was The Things We Carry. Marlies has very long hair, as does her great-grandmother, the person she, her mother, and her grandmother go to visit in this story. Here is Marlies' memory of that visit, a story she calls The Honey Wall.
So I'm about 7 years old for this story, and my hair is really, really long. It's almost down to my knees, and really light blonde. And my mom is meticulously curling every strand of it. And this happens whenever we need to be seen, right? You know, there's a holiday, or it's the first day of school, or pictures, or we have to sing Rudolph. In this case, we're going to see my great-grandmother, Anna, and that's a place to be seen. I'm not allowed to cut my hair as a child, and that's how it has become so long. And the boys at school tease me. They pull on it from behind me at my desk, and they close it in the lids of their desk. And one day, when they were pulling my hair, they actually were smashing large pieces of bubble gum into it behind me as I sat there. This was how I was assured that they really, really liked me. So I sat with my mom, much like when I did when she would do my hair, and she cussed a blue streak and smoked cigarettes and sobbed. And she tried everything that she could to get that out of my hair. And it started with peanut butter and ice and went to baby oil. But what finally did the trick was lighter fluid. I think I told you she was smoking, right? So even I knew that this was a pretty shaky idea. But I did not say anything, and you wouldn't have either. At night, my mom braided my hair so that it wouldn't become one solid, tangled mass as I slept. And in the morning, she pulled a brush through it again and softly told me that I had mermaid's hair. As a teenager, I would, in defiance, cut a huge chunk out of my hair, like right here, because I wanted a bob, and I wanted people to stop calling me Crystal Gale. And my mom rushed me to this lady's house who had a beauty shop in her basement. And she rushed me there in the car like I was bleeding out. And when it was all said and done, she made me carry that hair home in a plastic bag and give it to my father, who accepted it without looking at me. And he didn't say a word. And he just went up to the studio and he made paintbrushes from it with carved willow handles and copper wire. And she's done curling my hair now, and it's time to go, and I've got my best tights on, no holes in the knees, I'm all dressed. And we're going to see Grandma Anna in Belt, Montana, which is like 20 minutes from where I grew up in Great Falls. And this is a little place. So we've got to pick up my grandma, Eva, who is my mom's mom. And then we're going to see Grandma Anna, who's her mom. And we get there, we pick up Grandma Eva, and we drive all the way across town, which is like three or so blocks. And we get to Grandma Anna's house. And Anna had some magic in her. And we knew this because she never guessed any of the babies wrong in our family and like 20-some grandchildren until me. And I'm worried about whether Grandma Anna likes me. And I'm worried about whether or not I wrecked something for her by not being a boy. Her house is really, by all standards, a tiny, tiny shack. But it's honest and it's clean, and she works hard. And the whole deal is that I come and I be seen, and I know I'm supposed to go outside and play and be quiet after that, and that's how it usually goes. And I don't know what kind of business they're conducting in there whatsoever, but I know that I'm supposed to be out playing on the propane tank and minding my own business. You know, I'm a little scared of Grandma Anna because she's really quiet, and I know now that that was because there was a little bit of a language barrier. There was certainly a generation barrier, and she was maybe the oldest thing that I'd ever seen. Her house was as spare as could be, and the only things that I really remember that were decorative was the Last Supper hung on one wall, and then in the other room there was the one of the really good-looking Jesus. And that was it. But the most fascinating part about Grandma Anna's house, and that was consistent with the magic that she already had, was that a whole colony of honeybees had moved into the back wall of our home. And it really was built out of scraps, you guys. I'm not kidding when I say that. And there was no way to remedy this without taking the house down. And when it got really hot outside, as happens in Montana, that wall wept honey and wax. And that's what the room smelled like. And that was the most fascinating part about our house. And we were strictly forbidden from touching the honey wall. So I'm playing outside. I've been there a while, and I don't know. I need something, and I'm not sure what it was that day, but I know it must have been important because I was breaking the rule of being unheard, unseen, you know. And I went creeping in as quietly as I could because I knew that I wasn't supposed to disturb anything. And the moment that I walked in on has had maybe the most impact on me out of any image in my life. And it was like a big flash bulb went off in my head. What I walked in on was my grandmother and my mother on either side of Anna. And I forgot to tell you something really important. Her hair was white, so white that you would not be able to even imagine what color her hair had once been. And it was in huge braids coiled on either side of her head, the size of dinner plates. And that's important. Because what I walked in on was my mom and my grandmother on either side of her. And they were brushing her hair, and they had washed it. And she was sitting on a step stool between them, with her hair let down. They each had a brush, and it was not only so long that it hit the floor, it actually pooled on the floor by their feet. And behind her, the honey wall wept. And she was otherworldly, and she was beautiful. It wasn't a very long time after that day that I went to Belt again with my mom. And we were standing on the sidewalk, and I was really stubborn. I was resisting. And as was generally the case with my mom, I was not going to win. I'd been given the look, and it was over. And so I took her hand, and we walked into the small room on the side of the church in Belt, Montana. And my grandmother Anna lied there in a casket that was just half open. And I was terrified, terrified. I would still be terrified, you guys. I don't understand this open casket thing. But I was especially terrified then. And I looked at her, and what they had done to her was unforgivable. You know, she was such a plain woman, and she wore sturdy black shoes and a dress and apron, and everything was honest and clean. And they had her with a bright red bow for a mouth and blue eyeshadow, and her hair was waxed right to her head. And she had on this frilly, like chiffon-y, ruffly, bridesmaids-y kind of dress that I couldn't figure out what was going on with. And I remember having a couple of really distinct thoughts at that moment. And one of them was, her shoes must be ridiculous. This is insane. The other thought that I couldn't get away from that day was that she looked like this really creepy collection of dolls that my friend Corey had, that one was from every culture. And they kept me up at night when I stayed with Corey, because when you tipped them, their eyes opened and closed. And they were all the same size, and they were all from different cultures, and I couldn't figure out what culture they were trying to make her look like she was from. And I could only think that if she could just tip forward a little bit, and if her eyes would open just a touch, somebody would really be in big trouble for hookering her up this way. But really, I just prefer to think of that day when I saw her as a specter in a moment so beautiful that it's a gift to me. Thank you.
Marlies Borchers arrived in Missoula in 1990 with a mission to study fine arts and creative writing at the University of Montana. She is a second-generation ceramics artist, following traditions created by her father, Dean Borchers. Our final story is from Jeremy N. Smith, another one from our Dear Diary series. In this story, which Jeremy calls beautiful, his crush, Ann Crosby, teaches him the truth about physical beauty.
This is the story of my relationship with the most beautiful woman in the world. And it starts in seventh grade at a sleepover. There were no girls there, just guys. But at midnight, somebody organized us in a circle and said, okay, you're going to step forward one at a time, and you're going to say who you like. High pressure. But I knew who I liked. I'd actually liked the same girl for 3 years. I knew the exact date because I'd gotten a diary in fourth grade. And the first page, first entry I'd written, Ann Crosby. Oh, just marry the girl. And when I saw her in the hall, my legs would shake and my chest would burn and I would blink uncontrollably. And I would just try to talk to her for a few seconds and then I'd have to abort. But this was my chance. Put it out there for the world, see what happened. I get in the circle, I'm ready to step forward, and the guy goes, oh, just one more thing. No one can say Ann Crosby. Because, duh, that's obvious. And that duh was devastating to me, okay? Because I knew how special Ann was, and I knew how incredible she made me feel, but I had no idea that other people knew that too, that they felt the same way, that the entire school liked Ann Crosby. I didn't have a chance. I turned away from the circle, and I didn't even think about talking to her for 5 more years. If Ann Crosby was cute in fourth grade, if she was prettiest girl in school in seventh grade, by 12th grade, she was one of the most beautiful women in the country, and I can say this objectively, because when we had our yearbook photos taken, they got sent to this company in Texas that like processes every yearbook photo in the entire nation. And this company literally sees a photograph of every single high school student. In the United States of America, they choose one for their poster for ordering yearbook photos that goes in the hall of every high school in America, double life size, Ann Crosby. So whatever small chance I had when she was a local phenomenon was gone. Went to college. 4 years passed. Graduated. Went home. Get invited to a party not unlike the sleepover. Except this time, there are girls there. People I haven't seen in 4 years. People who haven't seen me. I walk in the door, push through, apartment in Chicago. First person I see, other end of the apartment, behind the kitchen counter, and Crosby. I know what you're asking. Was she still beautiful? Well, is the sun still hot, people? And Crosby was now like a CIA secret experiment, okay? She was beautiful on like a need-to-know basis. You literally could not conceive of her in her entirety. You could only focus on one part of her at a time, and you still had to like narrow your eyes and just kind of, you know, from the glare. But hey, I changed too, okay? I was super skinny. High school, I'd put on a little bit, you know, I was short, I'd got a little taller, I had glasses, now they were contacts. Not only in high school had I not kissed Ann Crosby, I hadn't kissed anyone. And in this interim time, I had kissed someone. Maybe gone a few steps past that, and with that, I had the courage to step forward until I'm 6 inches away from the sun. And I said, "Ann, how are you?" She could have ignored me. It would have been an honor, okay? She could have said, "Fine," like a normal person and turned around. She did something crazy, though. She answered the question seriously. And her lips are moving. That's the part I just decided to focus on. And I'm like narrowing my eyes, and they're talking to me. And this is what she says. She says, "You know, in high school, I love that we went to a diverse high school." This is Anne talking. "And I wanted that experience in college, so I went to Atlanta. And there was a lot of diversity there, but it was also really segregated where I went. That's what it turned out to be. And so if I tried to sit with someone who didn't look exactly like me, I got a lot of static from them, and I got a lot of static from the people who did look like me. And I was really lonely and alone." And I hear this, and I'm thinking, Ann Crosby is telling me she's lonely. Step forward, kiss her. But my legs shake, and before I can dare, she goes on. And she says, "Yeah, I transferred to a small college in Ohio. It wasn't a super diverse place, but my best friend Molly was there, and I just wanted a friend then. And I found that, and it was great for a little bit. Molly was on the soccer team, though. They traveled. One day, there was a bus crash, and Molly died." My eyes widen. I force them up from her lips to her eyes. And I say, "Oh my God, you know, I'm so sorry." And my arms kind of open, and I'm thinking, like, "You should / you could get to hug Ann Crosby." But my chest is burning. I can't do it. And she goes on again. She's like, "Yeah, I mean, after that, you know, her friends from the soccer team were the people who knew her best besides me. And we just hung out and we just cried together. And, you know, they were the only ones who understood what I was going through. And I, you know, even after the immediate shock of what had happened," this is Anne still talking, "she said, you know, those became my new friends. And I actually even started traveling with them to their games. And I would cheer them on from the sidelines and try to give them little tips if I could. And they seemed to appreciate it. And I realized, hey, I'm in a small town in Ohio, not a super diverse place, but what diversity there is actually on this athletic team. And on athletic teams in general, you find that people don't care what you look like or where you're from. They care, you know, who you are and what you do. And that meant a lot to me," Ann said, "you know, especially after losing Molly." And I realized a minute had passed. And I had not thought for that whole minute about what she looked like. I had actually been only focusing on the words she was saying, and that was strange. And I wanted to know what happened next, and I just said that. I said, "What are you going to do now?" And she said, "Yeah, I've been thinking about that, and I guess I'm going to go back to college and try to coach. You know, try to pass on what I learned to other people, just about who you are is what matters and being the best person you can be every day." And my eyes were kind of blinking, but again, it wasn't because of what she looked like. It was because I was actually moved by her story. And I kind of opened my arms again, but I didn't touch her. I just put them together and I just said, "You know, good for you. That's great." And we talked for like a minute more. I turned around. I went home eventually. And I got up the next day. And the crazy thing was I wasn't mad at myself for not having tried to kiss Ann Crosby. It was actually the first day in 12 years that I didn't want to kiss Ann Crosby. And it wasn't because she wasn't beautiful. She was like intergalactically beautiful. But her story was even more beautiful to me. And I realized at the end of her story, she had figured out what she wanted to be, a coach. And I figured out what I wanted to be, a writer. I wanted to hear people's stories about their life-changing moments or where they changed other people's lives. And I wanted to share them with other people. And that's what I've tried to do as a journalist and a writer since then. So it's been 10 years, and I haven't seen or spoken to Ann Crosby since that party. But tonight, for the first time in a long time, I think I'm going to remember her in my diary. Thank you.
Jeremy N. Smith is a writer who specializes in profiles of people and of ideas related to science, the environment, globalization, and food. I hope you've enjoyed these stories and you'll come out to a live session sometime soon. The next Tell Us Something event is March 29th, 2 days from now, at the Wilma in Missoula. The theme is, Why Didn't Anyone Tell Me? And in May, we'll host our first event in Helena. Look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and subscribe to the Tell Us Something podcast using your favorite podcasting app. You can hear all the stories ever told on Tell Us Something stages at tellussomething.org. Tell Us Something is proud to be fiscally sponsored by Missoula Community Foundation, providing leadership to Missoula nonprofits and inspiring long-term philanthropy in Missoula since 2007. For the good of Missoula forever. MissoulaCommunityFoundation.org. And by the bookstore at the University of Montana, our title sponsor since the beginning, serving the students, faculty, and staff of the University of Montana, as well as the Missoula community. And they have it all. Grizz gear, office supplies, computer retail and repair. Oh, and art supplies. It's where I go to get mine every time. MontanaBookstore.com. We're also grateful for support from Fact and Fiction, where books, authors, ideas, and readers interact. Find out what's happening at factandfictionbooks.com. And to the Top Hat Lounge, bringing great music to Missoula for over 60 years, the Top Hat hosts a variety of Montana-based artists and has become a destination for national touring musicians. The Top Hat also hosts comedy shows, films, performance art, and storytelling, and offers a unique dining experience centered around locally sourced ingredients. See their menu and event schedule at tophatlounge.com. And many thanks to the Wilma, a locally owned and independently operated venue that has been an anchor for the Missoula cultural and entertainment scene for almost 100 years. The Wilma was constructed in 1921 as a vaudeville house and later became a movie theater. After a major renovation, the Wilma is now a state-of-the-art live performance space in a spectacular historic building. Check out thewilma.com. Thanks to Cash for Drunkers, who provided the music for Tell Us Something Radio. Find them at cashfordrunkersmusic.com. Thanks to everyone who attends the events, downloads the podcast, and tells their stories, especially Susan Maruka, Nate Beal, Mike Robinson, Marlise Borchers, and Jeremy N. Smith. Tell Us Something Radio was produced and edited for radio by Cherie Newman. Until next time, I'm Mark Moss, encouraging you to craft your story and tell us something.